This is Michael Edward Miller. Coming up on Around It About, I'm speaking with author Alvin Townley about his new book, Defiant. It's about American POWs in North Vietnam.
So imagine living every day in a 4x9 foot concrete box with no windows. You have a bucket for your toilet facilities, and you get out for 10 minutes a day to dump your bucket. Somebody brings you some gruel, and they slide it under the door twice a day. At night, you sleep with leg irons, and you have nothing to do.
This is a true story. This is real history. It's about 11 men who survived Vietnam's most infamous POW camp and how their wives back home helped them get free. Stay tuned. A Rounded About starts in just a moment.
Funding comes from Sandy Maddox with Bellwether Investment Group, LLC, a local and independent investment advisory firm advising families and individuals from all walks of life. More information online at bellwetherinv.com. Funding comes from AWM, headquartered in Chattanooga, providing ISO 14065 accredited carbon credit verification, ISO 14001, ISO 50001, and OSAS 18001 certification to industry on the web at awm.net.
Hello, and welcome to Around It About Chattanooga. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. During the Vietnam War, hundreds of American soldiers were captured. Many of them were confined to POW camps, but 11 of them were singled out by the North Vietnamese. James Stockdale, Jeremiah Denton, and Nels Tanner, a Navy pilot from Tennessee, those are just a few names of those 11 soldiers. They were known as the Alcatraz 11. The North Vietnamese captured them and tortured them and tried to break their will and make them sign false confessions of war crimes and turn against America. But these 11 POWs stood up to the torture. Their captors sent them to a special prison, a special kind of hell, nicknamed Alcatraz. This is a true story, real history. Most of the soldiers lived through it and were released. Today, I'm speaking with author Alvin Townley. He wrote a book about this true story. St. Martin's Press recently published it. It's out in hardcover right now. The book is called Defiant, The POWs Who Endured Vietnam's Most Infamous Prison, The Women Who Fought For Them, and The One Who Never Returned. I spoke with Alvin Townley recently while he was in Chattanooga for a book signing. Alvin, welcome to Around It About.
Hey, thanks, Mike. It's great to be here.
First of all, you're from Georgia. Where in Georgia are you from?
I was born and raised and still live in Atlanta, Georgia.
So you're not that far from Chattanooga.
It's a quick drive.
Your book, Defiant, is about, as we were saying, this group of prisoners. The story takes place in the 60s and the 70s during the Vietnam War. I mean, North Vietnam, they took hundreds of prisoners of war, but these 11 men, what was so special about them? What was, as your title says, so defiant about these 11 men?
Well, basically, these 11 POWs were so obnoxious, uncooperative, and subversive, they got kicked out of the Hanoi Hilton POW camp. So if you want to find out how to get evicted or kicked out of a POW camp, read this book. I mean, these guys were the leaders of the resistance. These were guys that tried to escape or that did escape in one case, guys that embarrassed the North Vietnamese on a global level with some of the fake things they slipped into some of their confessions. So the North Vietnamese hated these guys and realized that these 11 were just ruining their entire re-education program. If they didn't get them out away from the other 400 or 500 prisoners, they were just going to lose control of the population.
And so they took these 11 prisoners and put them in a prison nicknamed Alcatraz. What were the conditions like in this prison that they called Alcatraz?
So imagine living every day in a 4x9 foot concrete box with no windows. You have a bucket for your toilet facilities, and you get out for 10 minutes a day to dump your bucket. Somebody brings you some gruel, and they slide it under the door twice a day. At night, you sleep with leg irons, and you have nothing to do. You sit there for 2 years and basically just rot away in this cell, and they had to come up with these amazing ways to keep their mind occupied so they wouldn't go crazy. And one of my favorite things in the book is all the different ways they communicate with one another, and I'll tell you about that a little bit later, but the way they communicate, the way they keep their minds occupied, the way they support and engage one another. And it's just an incredible story of surviving, you know, the whole 8-year experience. And these guys were there for 8 years, never knowing when and even if they were ever going to go home again.
Yeah, because as you say, many of them who got there thought they'd been out within like a year, maybe.
Piece of cake. Remember, this is 1965. These guys were American naval aviators and American Air Force pilots. And, you know, any pilot thinks he is the greatest pilot in the entire world as far as he's concerned. And so these are confident, competitive guys. And they thought surely their big, strong country was going to get them home. And, you know, they were there all of 1965, all of 1966, 67, 68, 69, 70, 71, 72, 73. And I don't say that to be repetitive. I say that just to emphasize how long these guys were there, how long they were away from their families, how long they had to continue having that moral courage to be defiant. They didn't have to have just a courage to get by. They didn't just try and, you know, do the minimum and get by. They had to have the nerve and the constant courage and the resilience to be defiant, to defy the North Vietnamese again and again, not sign the conventions, not sign the propaganda statements, not sell out their fellow POWs, and they had tremendous pressure put on them to do so.
I was surprised at just how readable this book is. I mean, it's about soldiers who spend 7 years as prisoners of war. It sounds like it's going to be a brutal story, and parts of it are explicit about what they endured, but it's so compelling because it's also about how they endured, how they kept sane, how they kept their sense of humor, how they fought the isolation. What are some of the specific things that they did to keep up their spirits, to keep in touch with each other, even though they weren't allowed to speak with each other a lot of the time?
Well, actually, I want to touch on one thing you said first. You talked about the book being readable, and one of the things I really wanted to do was make it read like a novel. And
yeah,
you know, if you go to Amazon.com and look up Defiant and look at some of the reviews, several people have said that. And you know, that's the biggest compliment I can receive because aside from the compliments from the POWs themselves,
and
you know, they've been very gracious and very supportive of the book, which is I can't express to you how happy that makes me. But you know, I wanted to make it engaging. I wanted to make it readable so that, you know, folks that are my parents' generation would read it, that our generation would read it, and people that are younger would read it. I wanted it to be a good read in addition to an important read, and I think we accomplished that. And you know, some of the things you talked about in terms of how these guys kept their minds busy and supported each other, you know, the TAP code was probably the most important thing. Every American that arrived in Hanoi would receive this grid. It might be carved in a wall. It might be dropped on a piece of toilet paper in his rice. It might be stuffed in a little crack in the latrine. It was a 5x5 matrix. And if you take 25 letters or 26 letters in the alphabet, which doesn't fit very conveniently into a 5x5 grid, so you take out the letter K and use C for K, you're left with 25 letters. You put them in a 5x5 grid with A, B, C, D, E across the top and A, F, L, Q, V down the side. A, F, L, Q, V down the side. And so you have a 25 different squares. And if you were trying to send the letter B, for example, you would tap once for the first row and twice for the second column. And these guys had nothing but time. So, you know, eventually they would just sit there and just tap out words and sentences. And these sentences would be, you know, spiritual substance. I mean, these are sustenance. These were things that kept each other going. They support each other. And, you know, we sometimes think of our generation as a generation that started, you know, abbreviated texting. These POWs were sending, you know, GN for good night and TM for tomorrow, you know, long before we were ever even thought of.
It's just amazing how they were able to keep a sense of humor. Sometimes, some of the things they said we can't necessarily repeat on the radio, but some of the responses they would have to what the communists, the North Vietnamese would say to them, they were, as the title says, just blatantly defiant. Why did they keep doing that? Because their captors made it very clear that, you know, if you would just submit to us, if you would just do what we're telling you to do, your life will be much better. Why did they keep basically spitting in these guys' faces?
That, Mike, that's one of the key things is you know, why they were so defiant when it would be so easy to give in. And, you know, these guys were getting tortured. And if you can imagine putting your arms behind your back and clasping your hands together, then having somebody pull your elbows together with rope. I mean, you know, your shoulders are popping out of joint. Your sternum's about to break. And they take your head and they raise your arms up over your head behind your back and slam your head down to your knees. Your knees are straight out. Your legs are in leg irons, and the pain was excruciating. But still, these guys fought as long as they could, not to compromise. And the North Vietnamese interrogators were saying, hey, we don't have to do this to you. We're not going to tell anybody. Just sign the confession. Just say you're a war criminal. Say this war is immoral. And these guys didn't, because all they had left after they got shot down, when they were thrown in a prison cell at 7,000 miles away from home, a dirty prison cell with a bucket for their toilet and two, paltry meals a day in pajamas, and they were scrawny, they were dirty. All they had left was their name and their honor. And they were not about to compromise their honor if they couldn't help it.
When the men got there, the first thing each one of them would do is say to these North Vietnamese captors, Geneva Convention, you can't do that to me. And those Geneva Conventions were not obeyed. Why weren't they obeyed?
It was great. One of my favorite lines is the guy, the American Nels Tanner, comes in and says, wait a second, I'm protected under the Geneva Convention. And the interrogator, who is nicknamed Rabbit, says, oh, yes, we know all about the Geneva Convention. We're just not going to honor it. And that was the situation the Americans faced, because in the North Vietnamese point of view, a declared war didn't exist between America and North Vietnam, so they had no reason to honor it, and they considered the Americans war criminals. And they called them that. That's all they referred to the Americans as, criminals, criminals, criminals. And that was one of the things that the American leadership, the guys that got kicked out, the Alcatraz 11, tried to remind the Americans that they weren't criminals. They were soldiers, and they had a code of honor to uphold.
One of the men got on national TV. He got interviewed by a Japanese journalist, and it was broadcast in America while he was still a war prisoner. He managed to kind of send out a secret message during that interview. What did he do?
So this is Jeremiah Denton, who became a United States senator from the state of Alabama after he got out. And he had been tortured for several weeks, and the purpose of the torture was to convince him it was a good idea for him to toe the communist line in the interview, to say the things that the North Vietnamese wanted him to say. And so he walked in the interview, and he didn't say what they wanted him to say, but he also did something else. When you see the footage, you see him kind of blinking, and you think that maybe the lights are bright, and they were. But if you know Morse code, you can tell that he's blinking again and again, T-O-R-T-U-R-E, torture. Now, Mike, I can barely, talk and write at the same time, but Jerry Denton was giving hard answers to interviews and blinking torture in Morse code at the same time. So, a brilliant guy, a daring act, and that was one of the first indications that the Americans got that our POWs were definitely being mistreated.
Because I think there might have been a feeling among some people in America that they weren't being mistreated. The propaganda was, oh no, they're being treated very well, they're being fed very well.
So here's the other side of the story. Defiant, that word applies certainly to these 11 POWs and all the POWs. It also applies to their wives. Because imagine being a military wife, and a chaplain comes to your house, the senior officer comes to the house, and they say, ma'am, your husband's been shot down. We think he's alive. We're not sure, because the North Vietnamese weren't telling us who was alive and who was dead, who they had captured and who had died in a crash. We think he's alive, but don't say anything. The official government policy is to keep quiet, keep your mouth shut, don't talk to the press, don't talk to anybody, and we'll take care of it. And so this is 1965, and if you're a military spouse in 1965, you do what you're told. So you say, okay, that's fine, and you keep quiet. Then you start to get indications that they're not being treated well. And there's a whole other story about some secret carbon-based secret letter correspondence that happens that, Sybil Stockdale, for example, learns her husband Jim is being kept in leg irons and beaten. And these women realize that the government is doing nothing, and that if they're going to get their husbands home safely, they're going to have to break that policy. So in 1969, these women have banded together across the country before email, before cell phones, just tons of letters and tons of time on the telephone, and they've become an organization, the National League. And these wives, three of the founders are wives of the Alcatraz 11, and they basically bring the case to the public and bring the case to the world. And within 3 or 4 months of them going public with these accusations of mistreatment, the North Vietnamese changed their treatment of the American POWs.
What made you interested in this story? What made you want to seek out these men and meet them, get their stories, and write a book about it?
So, I actually came across this story in a small way when I wrote my first book, which, you write about what you know. I'm an Eagle Scout. So I wrote about Eagle Scouts. And one of the Eagle Scouts I met was a POW named George Coker. And in the course of my knowing Commander Coker, One day he mentioned offhand the Alcatraz 11. I said, "Well, sir, what's that?" And he told me the story that's in Defiant. And, you know, I just thought that it was a, first of all, whether I wrote the story or not, that's my disclaimer, it is the most incredible story I have ever heard, bar none. It is amazing. And, you know, anybody that can find a better story, please tell me. But, I mean, just the epic nature and the suffering that went on. I mean, you know, these men and women in Defiant arguably have survived more for longer than any other group of servicemen and women in American military history. It's unbelievable what they go through. And so I just felt, you know, it was a great story that, you know, the older generations needed to be reminded of, the younger generations needed to learn. And you know, I've gotten to be so close with these families and these men. They're like, I feel like they're my grandparents. And, you know, and I love them. And I think it's so important for America to, A, know what they did, but also to understand what we can learn from what they did.
How do you go about approaching somebody and saying, you know, I know you went through this horrible, horrible thing, but would you sit down and relive it for me and tell me the details of it?
Well, you know, you get to be buddies with them. And, you know, Commander Cooker and I, you know, had a number of conversations. And so, you know, they're used to talking about it, but you kind of ease them into it. And, you know, you have to be very delicate. And particularly the wives, you know, the men don't mind talking about it nearly as much as the wives do. So there's one wife who is a very dear friend now, but, you know, it took a long time, you know, to warm her up where she felt comfortable with me. I think, you know, they had to understand that I wasn't there to exploit them. I was there to tell their story in an honorable way. And I think, you know, the support the families have given me has just been, you know, one of the greatest gifts of doing this whole thing.
That's Alvin Townley. His book is called Defiant. It's nonfiction. It's out in hardcover right now. Coming up in just a moment, we'll have more of our conversation with Townley. Stay tuned.
Support comes from Ohachi Glassworks, celebrating 20 years of offering blown glass functional art and sculptural lighting. In-studio consultations available by appointment. Information at PrenticeHicks.com.
Funding comes from CRS Exteriors and Infinity from Marvin Windows, where the manufacturing of the window creates less than 1% waste, which is 100% recycled. 423-486-9309, online at CRSExteriors.com.
You're just joining us. I'm speaking with Alvin Townley. His book is Defiant, The POWs Who Endured Vietnam's Most Infamous Prison, The Women Who Fought For Them, and The One Who Never Returned. It's out in hardcover right now. It's interesting. We were talking about this, the start of the POW MIA movement. I mean, this all happened before I was born. So to me, this has just always been there, the POWs, the MIAs. It's something I've seen throughout my life. So it's interesting to find out that no, it wasn't always there. These women had to struggle to put this together.
You know, when you look and see the black and white POW MIA flag flying, and it flies a lot of places, you know, you're looking at the most recognizable symbol of probably one of the most important women's movements in American history, and almost nobody knows it.
Yeah.
And that's what amazed me. Like you, I was born after the war, and I just had no idea that this was a women's movement. This is the movement that was started by these women who were concerned for their husbands. And, you know, everybody wears Livestrong bracelets and all sorts of cause-related wristbands today. But the original cause-related wristband was the POW MIA bracelet. And, you know, again, this is part of that movement. And over 5 million of these were printed, and people wore them around their wrist to remember the POWs, to remember the servicemen that were fighting the Vietnam War. Because for the first time in American history, we really needed to differentiate between the war, which was very divisive and unpopular, and the men that were fighting it. And that's one of the other things that the POW-MIA movement did, was really bring America together around the servicemen fighting the war.
Because that's very much the sentiment today. It's not support the war necessarily, it's support our troops.
Yeah, and the sad thing is when the POWs came home in 1973, after up to 8 years in these terrible conditions, they received this wonderful welcome. There were crowds, there were parades, and they thought it was just wonderful, until they realized that a lot of their brother servicemen, particularly the ones that were fighting down in the South, never received that welcome. And so one of the things I always do when I'm talking about the book is, you know, try and welcome home all the other Vietnam veterans that didn't receive that welcome.
Of the 11 men that you write about in the book, 10 did survive the prison and got out. How many were still alive when you started writing the book?
7. And, you know, they're, I think, range in age from late 60s to late 80s. And you know, one is currently a United States congressman from the state of Texas, Sam Johnson. One of the other guys who is no longer with us is Admiral Jim Stockdale. And a lot of people remember Jim Stockdale from the 1992 presidential race with Ross Perot, or seeing Phil Hartman portray him on Saturday Night Live. And I think if this book does anything, I want it to remind America that Jim Stockdale, who was a Medal of Honor recipient, who was a philosophy teacher at Stanford, master's degree from Stanford, Naval Academy graduate, that he really was one of the greatest leaders, you know, our country has ever seen. And I think people have forgotten that. And I want people to remember, you know, Jim Stockdale's example.
One of the things reviewers have said about your book is this story has been told before, the Alcatraz 11, but your book adds in the story of the wives and the birth of the POW-MIA movement, which hadn't really been told before. What made you decide I'm going to include that in this book?
Well, a couple of things. I love to say that this is the only bipartisan thing in America today, because we had both John McCain and Jimmy Carter give us wonderful endorsements and wonderful support for this. So that's been great. Probably means I can never run for office because somebody's going to be mad at me. But I hope that people can see that it really is something that appeals to everybody. Actually, the story of the Alcatraz 11 never been told before. That was kind of a new thing from the POW literature, and there is a decent amount of POW literature. But I realized meeting these guys that, you know, telling the story of just the guys in combat in country misses half the story. I think anybody that's been involved in a military family or knows a military family understands the sacrifices that the wives and the families are making back home and how important that support is. And, you know, particularly in this situation, these guys might not have come home if it weren't for the wives and their advocacy. And then from a strictly writing standpoint, you know, there's some rough stuff in the book. So, you know, I can have the reader in Hanoi with these guys getting beaten and tortured and or cracking jokes with each other. But, you know, usually it's some pretty intense scenes, and I can kind of take the pressure off and take them back to the United States, where it's still tough and the wives are still struggling and they're coalescing into this movement and making progress. But it releases some steam. It releases some pressure, and it really kind of advances the story in a pretty unique way. So I think it makes it a much more entertaining read that way.
We're talking about the women's movement. Do you think that's kind of what in some way enabled the women to do this? Because I'm sure there were POWs in wars before this, but as you were saying, this is the first time a POW movement came out of this.
Well, this is the first time where I think the wives felt that the government wasn't doing what it was supposed to, that, you know, if they didn't become advocates for their husbands, nobody was going to be an advocate for their husband. You know, I think World War II and previous wars, I think, felt that, you know, we were going to get the POWs out as soon as we won the war. But remember, in 1970, you know, the United States started withdrawing troops from Vietnam, and the POWs were still there. So the wives and the POWs were very concerned, I think legitimately, that we were going to withdraw all our troops and have no leverage at all to get the POWs out. And so I think, you know, that was really the women had to step up, and it had to become a movement because they really had to take responsibility.
You're just joining us. I'm speaking with Alvin Townley. Your first book, you were talking about that. It's really interesting. You went on this journey as an Eagle Scout around the United States talking to other people who were Eagle Scouts. Tell me about that, because you got to speak to some pretty prominent people on this journey that you were on.
Oh, it was great, Mike. You know, the nice thing about being an Eagle Scout is that you can sit down with the Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates, Secretary of the Treasury, Hank Paulson, Bill Gates Sr., Supreme Court Justice Stephen Breyer, Michael Bloomberg, Ross Perot, you know, folks like that, and have something in common. You know, I wasn't asking them to vote for something. I wasn't asking them for money. We were just talking about scouting. It's something we cared about, something that was really important. And I think that often in life we don't have time to revisit, you know, what it is that really makes us who we are. And I think for so many people that go through scouting, whether they reach Eagle or not, you know, I think anyone that's in scouting for any period of time really has a formative experience. I think it's good just to sit back and think about that. So that really got me a lot of access. I think these gentlemen were interested and excited to talk about this. And, you know, the more people I met, the more I realized that, you know, scouting really has shaped this country in such an amazing way. And, you know, I think the program today has its challenges, but it's more important than ever that we get more kids, I think, involved in scouting, or programs like scouting that, you know, give them a sense of character and right and wrong and personal responsibility. And my favorite, just a spirit of adventure.
What made you want to write a book about it specifically? Because I don't know if there are many books out there like that. What made you say, you know, this really would make a good book? Because obviously it worked. You sold it to a publisher.
Yeah, well, you know, publishers are sometimes like sheep. I hope this doesn't get replayed in New York City. But, you know, no one had ever done a book on Scouts. So you might think that means there's a huge market that's untapped. Well, the publisher thinks that means that there's not going to be a market.
Yeah.
So, you know, we had to convince them that this was something that a lot of Americans care deeply about. You know, 60,000 kids almost get their Eagle Scout badge every year. You know, there have been over 2 million Eagle Scouts in the course of history. There are, you know, around a little under 3 million Boy Scouts active today. It was a big group of people that I think was clamoring for somebody to tell their story in a positive way. And for me, I was really curious, you know, what it meant to be an Eagle Scout, what it meant to be a Scout when you've outgrown the uniform, when you're not going to a troop meeting every night, when you're in your 20s, when you're in your 30s. I was in my 20s when I started writing this the first book. You know, I wanted to know what it all meant. Did it matter? And how has scouting shaped America? And so for me, it was really a very personal question. And it wasn't necessarily going to be a book. I just wanted to find the answer to what it means to be a scout when you're, you know, in your 20s or 30s or even much older. And so the journey kind of became a book. And I'd sold my house and quit my job. So I put it all on the line. And
wow.
It was just a great journey. And, you know, the book came out. And we went through 10 printings in the first year, and we sold over 100,000 copies. And, you know, it's just Legacy of Honor is the first book. Spirit of Venture is the second book about Eagle Scouts. And one's about some older, more respected people. And the second one, Spirit of Adventure, is about guys that are in their 20s and 30s living great adventures with a greater purpose. And, you know, that's really what I see scouting doing, is igniting the passion for adventure and the passion for purpose. And I think those are two vital things for us.
Did you want to be a writer before that? Because a lot of people have good ideas for books, but it's not enough to have a good idea. It's not enough to even follow up on the idea. You've got to have the skills as a writer to make the story interesting to people.
Good Lord. You know, I would never wish being a writer on anybody. But, you know, I just had a story that I needed to tell. And I had done a lot of writing, and people told me I was a good writer. So I thought I could certainly do it. But, I never really anticipated how hard it was going to be. And, you know, it's a hard road, and you need the skills to sell a proposal, so you got to be a salesman. Then you got to be a researcher and an interviewer. Then you have to be a writer. Then you have to be an editor. Then you have to be a shameless promoter. And so there are all these different skills that it requires that I think a lot of people don't realize.
Oh, yeah.
But for me, that's why I could never write something I didn't really care about, because, you know, you devote yourself to it for, you know, 2 or 3 years. And so I, you know, care passionately about scouting. I care very passionately about these POWs and our veterans. And so that's why, you know, I spend the time I do and just try and travel as many places as I can and talk to as many folks as I can to kind of spread the message.
When you were talking with the veterans in Defiant, getting them to tell your stories, how did this affect them long term? Did you get the idea that, you know, this had done something to them on a deep level? Was this something they could just kind of move past?
You know, so they were when they came home in 1973, they got 3 months off, and they went back to work.
3 months.
3 months and went back to work. And, you know, I think some of them will tell you there certainly have been, you know, some nightmares and some, you know, maybe some times they've been unsettled, and they probably haven't told me the full extent. But honestly, they really kind of moved back to their lives and just, you know, went on with their lives. I think one of the key things is, you know, when they came out of solitary confinement, they've been in solitary confinement, you know, 1965, 66, 67, 68, 69. So, you know, 5 years in solitary confinement, you know, which is a brutal, awful punishment, you know, and that's just something that shouldn't happen. And this is, you know, one of the guys, Ron Storrs, didn't make it back because of solitary confinement. They got released from solitary confinement into a larger cell. So they were, you know, 1970, instead of being with just themselves, they were with, you know, maybe 40 or 50 other guys. And I think they all think that 3 or 4 years with that many people kind of helped them gradually readjust to just being with people and not, you know, not, they were kings of their own little cell, and they had to kind of learn how to be with people again. And, you know, their wives were supportive, the military was supportive, and they just got back to work. And I think for whatever reason, that seemed to you know, work for him.
One of the men actually lives here in Tennessee. Tell me about him.
Nels Tanner I hope Nels is listening. He's out in Covington, Tennessee, which is outside of Memphis. And you know, let me tell you, if anybody is over in Covington and wants to stop by the Tanners, they will fix you a wonderful meal and have a good drink of Jack Daniels with you. But yeah, Nels, you know, came back and started flying for FedEx, and you know, went on to build the house that he had designed in his mind when he was trying to keep himself occupied when he was in Alcatraz. And it was this beautiful open airy house that he wanted as few walls as possible. But you know, he got to do that, and you know, he's always good to see, and again, someone else who is really supportive of this whole initiative.
The idea of torture is something that's been in the news in the last few years with Guantanamo Bay. Writing this book, did it change your views on torture?
You know, I hadn't really thought about torture too much until I wrote this book. The POWs all have their own opinions. A lot of them will tell you that they don't really agree with torture because it's not effective.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't think any of them ever said anything true when they were getting worked over. And so, you know, I think a lot of them think that it's not effective. And I think, you know, we have to, whatever kind of punishment and whatever kind of means we're dishing out as a country, I think we always need to be very careful about, you know, the values that America has and the values we stand for. And, you know, we have to protect our way of life. We also have to remember that we have a way of life, and we need to honor that way of life, those values.
Is there anything else you want to say?
You know, I hate plugging books. I know I'm supposed to as a writer, but you know, this is just an incredible story, and I think it's hard to read in some places. It's funny in some places. It'll make you cry in some places, but it is overall just so inspiring. And you got to make it to the end because that's where the payoff comes.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's just such an inspiring book and such an important story that you know, and you can take it on so many levels. So I can't imagine living not knowing the story. And so I hope that people do. You know, pick up the book and they read it, and they understand what these guys went through, and they think about that, you know, when they're going through their daily lives.
Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Mike. It was a pleasure to be here.
You can find Alvin Townley online. His website is alvintownley.com. He's also on Twitter, @AlvinTownley. And just an addendum to this interview, when I recorded the interview with Townley while he was here in Chattanooga, Jeremiah Denton was still alive. Denton was the prisoner who famously blinked in Morse code and spelled out the word torture during a television interview. Recently, Denton passed away. Denton was 89 and became a U.S. senator after his release. That's it for Around It About Chattanooga. Thank you all for listening. I am your host, Michael Edward Miller. If you have questions, comments, or story ideas, you can email me, mike-miller@utc.edu.
Around and About Chattanooga is a production of WUTC with contributions by the staff and volunteers of WUTC. Find us online at wutc.org.